This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people, the places, and the packages of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Let's talk about all the stuff that arrives at your home and the packaging it comes in. You may have been dealing with a lot more wrapping materials in the past year. You know, e-commerce sales exploded during the pandemic. Steve McAdam teaches product and packaging design at Otis College of Art and Design. He and his students are trying to tackle the problem with a different way of thinking.
The point is we're living on top of trash. Trash is all around us. It's becoming our environment. How much more do we want trash to take over our environment is the big question.
Today, as part of our series, Wasted, we'll look at whether it's possible to do your online shopping without making more trash. KCRW's design and architecture expert, Francis Anderton, and reporter Kaylee Wells have the story.
I'm going to open this one.
Hi, I'm Francis. Hear that, Kaylee? That was the happy sound of gifts being ripped open at a birthday party.
Yes, Francis, I know the sound. Ripping, though, is a great word, because to get that game or new iPad or sweater, you probably had to fight through layers of packaging. A large box coated in fancy inks, maybe, styrofoam chips underneath that, paper wrappings, metal or plastic ties.
And that crazed effort to unwrap packaging, it even has a name.
Yeah, wrap rage. We learned about it from Catherine Hahn. She is a design student at Otis College.
The product that I think of the most are like scissor packaging, because it's like it's completely sealed in plastic. You have to use scissors to cut them open. So I find like very ironic, because you need like the tool that you're trying to purchase to open it.
And that package was no doubt shipped in yet another box, because most of us these days shop online.
Hello?
Delivery.
Thank you very much.
Have a good day.
And online retail went up astronomically after the pandemic hit. Here's Steve McAdam, professor at Otis.
Packaging has become a very big issue since the pandemic. I think it's made us aware of how much packaging we handle and how we're more or less responsible for throwing that packaging out. And we've become a little less respectful of companies that continually hit us with streams of packaging with the products we buy.
Exactly. Last year, it actually went up more than 30% over the year before. That means more boxes, more bubble wrap, more little air-filled plastic bags, most of which all end up in the landfill.
And so we're going to look at packaging and how to reduce it. There's a couple of ways.
One of them is to minimize all that bubble wrap, styrofoam, all those air pillows.
And Kaylee, I think you know about that from personal experience. Tell us about it.
You're right, I do. So I happen to actually be a recipient of a monthly curated box aimed at people who are concerned about the environment, which I am. And so my mother-in-law gave me this subscription. This company is based in Marina del Rey. It's called CauseBox. And here's the head of social impact, Carly Burson.
All of our packaging is upcycled from basically discarded fashion waste, which is, it's a beautiful, amazing handmade process. But we also switched to an environmental void filler. It's an amazing product called Paperwave, and it's an alternative to the plastic air pillows that you see in, say, Amazon packages and beyond.
They say these measures cut into their profits, but it's worth it to them because it fits their brand.
Well, Carly Burson is certainly very good at promoting her product. But I'm wondering, Kaylee, if you really want to reduce the amount of packaging, should we actually be starting with the shipping and trying to reduce that?
That's a great point. And that brings us to a very different way of approaching the problem. We're going to hear from some designers who are thinking about it. And you met with them, right, Francis?
Yes, I met some faculty and students at Otis College of Art and Design. Now, what is interesting is that I first met with packaging designers at Otis around 10 years ago. And at that point, manufacturers mostly still wanted bigger, better, brighter. There's even a term among designers for that kind of packaging, bloat.
There is so much packaging bloat.
Susan Benningfield also teaches in the product design department at Otis.
There's a shift in this, though. People are becoming much more aware of the packaging bloat, and they are seeking solutions for how to reduce this in general.
So now the faculty is getting students to think as much about the footprint of the stuff that gets shipped as the package it's wrapped in.
It's not the heavy glass bottle
around the olive oil that's the problem, really. It's the fact that you want that olive oil that came from Greece or Spain or Italy.
Jonathan Fidler is also a product designer and teacher at Otis. And as you heard, he's asking students to think about entire systems. And I have to say, it seems to be making things a bit more challenging for those students.
What we are really asking our students to be is not packaging designers, but understanding a system and designing either a new system or within that system and making small improvements along the way.
So what I'm hearing is that he wants them to understand the design of a product and its transport from beginning to end, not just the item or the wrapping around it, as package designers used to do.
That's exactly right, Kaylee. So let's go back to Jonathan Fidler's example of that glass bottle of olive oil.
So do we grow olive oil in the Central Valley, but then that wastes water? And you could go on, it's a never-ending design challenges.
So the conversation about packaging becomes a conversation about the life cycle of products.
That's right. And it acknowledges that sometimes you reduce one environmental impact over here, and then another one pops up over there.
And if you want to stop doing that, environmentalists call that closing the loop, which is really hard.
Never ending, as Fidler said. Just as an example, he told us that students might want to use bioplastics because that sounds better than single-use plastics.
Yeah, but there's a but, right?
Of course, because then they find that transporting them causes a lot of energy use and waste. Or they believe that paper bags are better for the environment than plastic, except that turns out not to be true when those bags are heavier. And then when they compost or biodegrade, they give off methane, which is worse than carbon dioxide.
Frances, this is kind of discouraging. I mean, it's got to be really bewildering for the design students.
It certainly is. Just listen to Amber Cooper. She's a student at Otis.
Sustainability is so, so confusing. We have like a lot of greenwashing going on, and it's hard to say the effects of when you're trying to be sustainable and then it kind of backfires in your face and there's that one thing you didn't think about that you're not accounting for.
Yes, these poor students seem to be starting to worry that their profession itself is the problem. Here's student Ming Duplashane.
I think being a designer is like creating stuff. And obviously with like the sustainability and environmental problems that we have today, it's like, do we really need to be designing and making more things?
Well, yes, you do, says the head of department, Steve McAdam. People will keep on wanting and needing things. So the students' challenge is simply to make them better and to last longer. And then McAdam says, consumers have to choose that stuff, even if it costs more.
You are the ones that are creating your future. You are the ones that have the ability to change that future. Look at what's going on now and ask yourself how you want to live in that future. It's a question all of us have to ask.
So we started trying to figure out better packaging, but we're ending up saying it's important to be aware of the environmental costs of all that stuff you're buying, because the packaging may just be the least of it.
That's exactly right. Small boxes are better than bigger boxes, but maybe think twice about whether you need to have that box delivered at all. For KCRW, I'm Frances Anderton.
And I'm Kaylee Wells. Next week, we'll meet some people who took that advice to heart and are doing their part by buying nothing.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Now for a conversation about the sense of smell and navigating life without it. Charlotte Quintana lives in Ladera Heights. She got COVID-19 back in March of 2020.
Around March 15th, I got something like a head cold, which turned out to be COVID. And around March 21st, I lost my sense of taste and smell. And that was full on. I couldn't smell anything, couldn't taste anything at all.
Tens of thousands of people have lost the ability to smell this past year after contracting the virus. It is a medical condition called anosmia. For many, that sense of smell comes back slowly over time. But in Charlotte's case, her sense is doing some really unusual things.
After about 6 months, it turned into distorted taste and smell. And so now for the past 6 months, everything I smell and taste is distorted, and it's kind of opposite of what it should smell and taste like. So it's a big hassle.
Anna Thorup can relate. She lives across town in Glendale. And while Charlotte lost her sense of smell last year, Anna has never really had a sense of smell.
Yeah, so I was born with congenital anosmia, and it's something I didn't really recognize until I was a little bit older, just because it was a sense that I never really had. I've since learned that I do have a sense of smell, but it is very, very muted and very, very mild. But it took me a long time to sort of come to terms with that, the fact that that's what it was.
We brought Charlotte and Anna together so Charlotte could ask Anna some questions and Anna could offer Charlotte some advice on living without smell.
Can you taste?
I can taste. That's often the first question that I get. So my sense of taste, ironically, has not been impacted. But I have noticed that over the years, I've started sort of gravitating towards certain flavor palettes. And I've realized that the flavor palettes that I've gravitated towards are ones that I can faintly smell.
Oh, okay.
So like mint is something that if it's very, very strong, I can smell it. Or citrus, specifically grapefruit, I can also smell if it's pretty strong. And those are both flavor combinations that I've always been attracted to. So I think that there's definitely some connection there.
And have you tried a lot of treatments to try to get your smell back throughout these years? Or
you know, I haven't actually. We have an idea of what we can attribute it to. And I've been to a couple doctors to chat about it and figure it out. But they're not entirely sure what's causing it. So we're not entirely sure how to combat it and how to fix it. And, you know, for me, it's something that I've never had. So in a way, it doesn't feel like as strong a loss, if that makes sense.
Right, like you're missing out on anything.
Yeah, yeah.
So since it's nothing that you're missing out on, does it affect your day-to-day life or your mental health, do you think?
You know, in different ways, I think that I'm definitely more aware of the safety element of not being able to smell. And that's something that I think about a lot, especially having moved across the country to Los Angeles. I'm more aware of, you know, being worried about things like gas leaks or fires or things like that. And I had actually a friend who was visiting me a couple years ago who walked into my apartment and realized that it smelled like gas. And I actually had a gas leak and I didn't know.
Oh my goodness.
So I've done things like invest in different types of detectors and more detectors than I think the average person would have.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's also just an element of closeness and trust that I have with my friends and partners and things like that to tell me if anything smells off or if anything feels amiss or something like that. So it definitely takes a level of openness.
Well, so far I've already had situations where I've drinking milk that was rotten, turkey meat that was bad. I think pork chops, we opened pork chops from the store and I started to salt and pepper them and my boyfriend came up and he goes, no, don't eat those. Those aren't good. And so who knows, without someone around, who knows what I'd eat if I can't smell it.
Absolutely.
So that's a main concern to me. And also the same thing with fire. I was looking into investing in smoke detectors, different gas detectors, just situations where I can't smell and I have to rely on other people around me and trust other people.
Absolutely.
You know, for my job, if I smell, if I body smell, if my perfume is too strong, actually I can't wear perfume anymore. So yeah, it's just, you have to trust in a lot of people. And do a lot of people believe you?
You know, it's so funny. It goes back and forth. There will be people who don't, just because they can't really fathom that I don't have a sense of smell but I have a sense of taste, and they don't quite understand where that comes from. And other people who
they don't understand.
Yeah. Can't fathom that that's something that I go without. So it is wild. I remember a couple of years ago, I told somebody that I can't smell, and I've gotten so used to just the response of disbelief. And it was crazy to me that she instantly was like, oh, my husband can't smell either. It's a rare thing to find.
Yeah, now it's seeming to be more common, but I'm coming across a lot of people who think it's a positive thing. They're like, oh, wow, you're so lucky.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah, maybe after 2 weeks I'm lucky, but after a year of this, that's not so lucky anymore.
Right. Right. And there's so many more things that I think you do have to be aware of that people don't think about. You mentioned spoiled food, and that's definitely a concern for me as well. I find that I get rid of food quicker, even if it might still be good. You know, there's the idea of expiration dates don't mean anything really, but I'm kind of live and die by expiration dates.
Yeah, we can't chance it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Like I said before, most doctors are pretty, most likely you're not going to get it back, so get used to it. So
yeah,
any coping mechanisms, anything that can get you through is appreciated.
Yeah, I would say, you know, find a group of people or just have people in your orbit that you trust and feel that you can be open with, both about, you know, how you smell or how your environment smells or things like that. Also, just do the things that make you feel safe and most comfortable, whether that be stocking up on different kinds of detectors or being more liberal with getting rid of food if you don't feel comfortable eating it, or if you have any questions. I think just find those things that make you feel the most comfortable living without a sense of smell.
And I think now after this year of COVID, I think there's going to be a lot more people with this that are going to understand it more.
Definitely.
That was Anna Thorup, who lives in Glendale. She's never really had a sense of smell. Talking to Charlotte Quintana from Ladera Heights, who lost her sense of smell last year due to COVID-19 and has yet to get it fully back. You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. In the past few weeks, several videos depicting anti-Asian violence have gone viral. And as a result, there are fears that the videos reflect a growing trend, a rise, perhaps, in racism and violence against Asians and Asian Americans. Here in Los Angeles, the scene of its own possible hate crime in Koreatown just last month, there's one activist who's trying to do something about it, to help citizens protect themselves, trying to help them.
You know, my mother used to say, always look for the helpers. Anybody who is coming into a place where there's a tragedy. Oh, baby, because if you look for the helpers, you'll know that there's hope.
Esther Lim is writing up and circulating booklets titled How to Report a Hate Crime. It offers simple guidance on how to recognize and report hate crimes in multiple languages and for various regions. And Esther is with us right now. Welcome to you.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So you have booklets, and I was taking a look at some of these booklets online. You have booklets in 7 different languages, right? And in 3 different regions across the country. There's one here in LA and Orange County. There's one for New York City, and there's one for the Bay Area, San Francisco and Oakland. Who did you set to make these booklets for?
The elderly, the most vulnerable, because since the hate crime incidents that began last year against Asians that were more prominent and more blatant, I feel like the target victims were the older, non-English speaking people.
These books, by the way, are in different languages, but also in English as well. So they can pretty much go to anyone. But when you look at it, I mean, you see there are a lot of Asian languages, but there's also Spanish as well, right?
Of course. You know, hate crimes are universal. And I think any person should be protected and know their rights. The Hispanic population in LA County, it's almost 50% of the population. So I want to protect them too. you know, it's just human kindness that should resonate more than hatred.
This is radio, Esther, so it's you know, we're trying to give people a sense of what these booklets look like. They're very colorful. They come in different colors for each of the languages that you've laid out. Describe the books, if you wouldn't mind, and what's sort of in the pages going through those books.
So in the content of the book, there are sections that explains what a hate crime is, what a hate incident is, the psyche of people who commit hate crimes, why they do it, effects of the hate crimes, the importance of reporting, knowing your rights, preventative tips, what to do when facing an attack, what to do after an attack, reporting a hate crime right away, the California state remedies for a hate crime for victims and witnesses, and then a contacts page where it also lists nonprofit organizations that take in hate crime reports and the hate crimes division of that local PD. And in the back, I think, which is the most important, are translated English phrases of how to seek help from a bystander, where they would just flip over to the back of the page. If they're being harassed by somebody, they can just flash the page if they don't know how to speak English to somebody next to them to seek help. For example, English isn't my first language. This person is harassing me. Can you help me or stay next to me?
Have you been the victim of a hate crime yourself?
I have not, but I'm a very empathetic person, so my heart hurts whenever I hear or see somebody being attacked.
And you see it all over the place, you know?
I do. And I've been, you know, a victim per se of like microaggressions, and that's what I'm used to, so I don't take it so personally. But when I created these booklets, I just, you know, was very, very worried for my parents. And you know, the psychological trauma that would be imposed on them after it happened, I just couldn't bear the thought of it. And it's a scary time.
It is a scary time. And you know, obviously getting it out there, making the booklet is one thing, but getting it into people's hands is another. I'm sure it's a big challenge, because you can print these out and put them in places, but people, you know, you want people to use them. You want people to have them just in case. How do you go about getting one of these booklets if you need one?
So you can find these booklets in LA. The main pickup location is in Koreatown at the California Market on the second floor of a ceramic store called Hua's Hopan. There are also booklets circulating in Oakland and San Francisco, but currently I have a GoFundMe page and I'm receiving donations for more printing to be done in LA and New York. $12,000 of it is going to printing for Oakland NSF, but hopefully this booklet will be printed as is, given to people's local communities. This is like an initiative that people can take so easily. Just print this out, like maybe on letter paper, and then give it to your parents or your grandparents and talk it through with them. This is supposed to bring the two generations together as well, which is why I had the English translation in the booklets.
Well, I want to thank you for your time and for what you're doing, Esther. Esther Lim, an activist and creator of the How to Report a Hate Crime booklet. Esther, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
By the way, if you'd like more information or perhaps to download a copy of the booklet, you can find out more at hatecrimebook.com. That's hatecrimebook.com. That's going to do it for us today. In the coming days, you're going to hear more about a proposal to disallow natural gas from new construction in Santa Barbara. Why the plan? And who is not on board with the plan? Also, a look at the future of cars. More electric ones for sure in the future, but what about other kinds of energy to fuel those cars? Those stories, many others too, in the coming days on Greater LA. Check us out at our website, kcrw.com/greaterLA. Hear the stories of LA, the people who make up this place, and of course, all the places and beyond of greater LA. Subscribe to the podcast too. Have it delivered fresh to your feed at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, PJ Shahamat, Chuck P., Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Mario Saavedra, Mike Stark, and Christian Bordahl. We're all here putting this show together tonight. I'm Steve Chiotakis, honored by your support of this show. Have yourself a great night.